Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 24th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Kristen, let's start this week in Sandwich. For a long time, the town has been working toward a solution to the problem of erosion at Town Neck Beach. It now has state approvals for a big piece of that, but it's waiting on the Army Corps of Engineers.
That's right. The town of Sandwich has approvals from three permits that it needs from the state and is waiting on a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers for a sizable dredging project that the town is hoping will give sort of a permanent solution to the issue of erosion at Town Neck Beach. And what the project would do is take materials from a site off Scusset Beach to replenish the beach. Under the Army Corps permit, it would allow the town to excavate up to 225,000 cubic yards of sand and gravel materials from a 23-acre subtidal site, and that would then be transported, pumped out, dewatered, and used for dune and beach reconstruction under the permit. So the Army Corps right now is in the process of evaluating public interest over a period of 30 days. As you mentioned earlier, Sandwich does already have other permits in place that it needs to move forward with the project. And what the director of the town's Natural Resources Department is saying is that this is going to be a sustainable way for the town to deal with the persistent problem of erosion, especially now that the town is seeing more and more frequent storms. Over the past winter, the town estimates that it lost a record chunk of its dune, which amounted to about 40 to 50,000 cubic yards of sand during that string of nor'easters that we had from January to March. It also left the Sandwich Boardwalk broken and impassable. That has since been fixed. The Army Corps is saying, or what's happening here also is that the Cape Cod Canal jetties are thought to possibly be contributing to this. They're saying that the health of the dunes at Town Neck Beach has been impacted because sand gets trapped by the jetties that might otherwise migrate down and replenish the dunes. And the Army Corps is looking into whether the federal government should step up and take more responsibility for the erosion at Town Neck Beach. It's conducting a study known as Section 111, which is looking at that and the possibility that the town could receive millions of dollars in support from the federal government to sort of rectify the situation there. But the results of that study are still far off. It's not supposed to be wrapped up till the end of the year.
So the town, with these approvals in hand, is hoping to move forward with this project. Do they have a general time sense of when something like this could happen?
Well, they're hoping that the project, which is supposed to take about 2 months, could be done between the months of November and March.
And it's such an involved bureaucratic process to get there. I know that they had to apply to a number of different environmental agencies to make this come together.
Yes, they did. The Department of Environmental Protection, the Office of Coastal Zone Management, and the Army Corps as well.
So this will be a public comment period for the next 30 days in which the Army Corps of Engineers is looking to hear from community about the project going forward. Scientists and county officials are watching for signs that a new tick species may be making its way onto the Cape.
That's right. The tick, which is known as the Asian or longhorned tick, has been found in 8 states throughout the U.S., including New York and Pennsylvania. I guess the first one that they can trace it back to was pulled off a woman who was shearing sheep in New Jersey last year. And the tick, scientists are saying that the tick could become a problem because females can lay larvae without help from males, which gives it the opportunity to reproduce rather rapidly. But they're also saying not to push the panic button just yet. The tick does carry its own sort of host of diseases, but none of those have been found in the ticks that came across to the U.S. And what scientists say they're really looking at, and what the main concern is whether the tick could possibly pick up local diseases transmitted by ticks that are already in the area, such as Lyme disease or babesiosis. They're saying the way that might happen is if the tick bit into an animal, such as a white-footed mouse, for example, that is often infected with Lyme, and then could pick up the bacteria and transmit it that way. Other scientists scientists, including those at the Tufts School of Veterinary Medicine, have said that a similar situation happened in New Zealand and Australia when the tick made its way there, but there's been no public health issue as a result. So that is a good sign.
And the question is whether this is going to make it even onto the Cape. They haven't found this yet on the Cape.
That's right. It hasn't. I believe it hasn't even been found in Massachusetts, as far as I know. And the issue would the tick be able to get across the bridge, or how would that happen? It has been found in Arkansas, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia.
And if it makes it here, there's really nothing to do except continue the same precautions that people take against ticks.
That's right. Scientists are saying just, you know, do the same thing you always do when you go into a wooded area to avoid a tick bite. Wear permethrin-treated clothing and make sure you have light-colored clothing and tuck your pants into your socks.
Let's take a look at this story about the November election bringing a statewide ballot initiative which will limit how many patients a nurse can care for. And it's a question that's beginning to raise a lot of debate.
Yes. So members of the Massachusetts Nurses Association and other proponents of the question's passage met recently in front of Partners Healthcare in Somerville to call for increased nurse staffing levels and to protest multimillion-dollar-plus pay for hospital CEOs. And what the advocates of this bill are saying is that companies, healthcare companies, are putting profits ahead of patients and that they can afford to improve staffing to ensure patient care. Some of the things that this bill would call for is a limit to the number of patients a nurse can care for, and it would use research-based evidence-based research to set those maximum limits. Nurses would be able to care for, two post-anesthesia patients per nurse, and five stable patients per nurse under if the question passes.
And right now, there are no limits for nurses, I understand, except maybe in intensive care units?
That's right. We spoke with a Cape Cod hospital nurse who said she sometimes had to care for seven patients at a time when she worked on a medical surgical floor, and that there are, except for in the case of intensive care units, there are no limits to the number of patients that a nurse can have, and that can really affect things, and sometimes patients don't get the care they need.
And the system right now that the hospitals are saying that to have this initiative passed would be a burden for them.
That's right. Hospitals are saying that it could cut margins, that it could force the hospitals to look at programs such as opioid or behavioral health programs that don't bring in a lot of money, that they may have to look at cutting back on in some of those areas. But proponents of the bill are also saying, wait a minute, Cape Cod Hospital is the most profitable nonprofit hospital in the state, and that it pays its CEO, Michael Loff, up to $2 million a year over the past few years, and that it can afford to take some of these advances to help patient care. Loff has said that the system would have to add 250 nurses under the bill if it passes at an annual cost of $34 million.
Let's speak right now with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Bill. Bill, a couple of visitors of note to the island this week, both with political connections. The first is poised to become the first Somali woman in Congress. Tell us about her.
Yeah, it was an exciting week. I mean, a lot of politicians come here in August, you know, mostly attending fundraisers. But Ilhan Omar came with a film about her. It's a documentary called Time for Ilhan, directed by Nora Shapiro. And interesting thing, this documentary was shot. This follows her 2016 campaign for state representative in Minneapolis. That campaign, her win was big news because she was the first Somali woman to win elected office. But now, 2 years later, on August 14th, she won the primary for Keith Ellison's vacated seat, the 5th District of Minnesota, and is now, yes, likely poised to become the first Somali woman in Congress, which is, so the film, which is already big news, has now been taken on a bigger life because of what she's been able to do.
And folks turned out to hear her speak?
Yes. She's very dynamic, you know, very small woman, but very dynamic, and just people are really, really, you know, falling in love with her. She's 35 years old, a mother of three. She moved to the U.S. as a refugee from Somalia when she was 12 years old, and a family settled in Minneapolis, which actually has the largest Somali population here in the U.S., and then after college, she started this meteoric political rise, starting as a community organizer. And she really is sort of what looks to be like a wave of a new potential of diversity in elected office in Congress. She's actually going to be one of most likely two Muslim women to win a seat in Congress, the other being Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, who after winning her primary on August 7th, went over to Minneapolis to help stump for Ilhan. So pretty exciting times.
Bill, you also had a certain former president on the island there talking about his new book.
Yeah, Bill Clinton was here, and he has been always been a huge and popular presence on the island. Here he was coming to talk about his first foray into fiction. He wrote a book called The President is Missing with James Patterson and was filled the Performing Arts Center here to talk about it. The book hinges on a cybersecurity issue, which he said he told the audience is a much bigger threat, you know, than we can understand it to be. So, you know, sobered some audiences there. But he got a lot of fun, and he talked about how his process with James Patterson was James would send him a list of questions that only the president would know, for instance, how to sneak out of the White House. So it was a lot of fun. But the biggest round of applause for the night was when Hillary Clinton stepped out on stage and waved to the audience. And to that, Bill Clinton said, "There's the real missing president."
Mm. Bill Evel, managing editor at the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great day.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, a couple of stories this week relating to local marijuana regulation as towns continue to feel their way forward on this. In Falmouth, it looks like a medical marijuana dispensary may be a step closer.
That's right. Selectmen in Falmouth voted in favor of approving in concept a draft host agreement with Nature's Remedy of Massachusetts, which is hoping to open in a strip mall on Route 28. Under the host agreement, the town could be supplied with payments of up to $300,000 annually. Now, the board took the vote saying that they wanted to let the applicant know that they eventually want to sign on the deal, but they're not ready quite yet. First, they want to hear some more from townspeople before they go ahead with a formal vote on a host agreement. Host agreements are not required by the state for medical marijuana dispensaries, but applicants often have to present letters of support or non-opposition from the host community leaders, and that sort of gives the town some leverage in getting a financial agreement with the business.
What are the things that the town are looking for from this agreement?
So under the terms of the agreement, Nature's Remedy would pay Falmouth 3% of its gross sales revenue on a quarterly basis for 5 years. And because Nature's Remedy expects to make $7 to $10 million in annual gross sales, that amounts to about $150,000 to $300,000 for the town. The agreement also includes other benefits for the town. Dispensary staff would provide educational programs on public health and drug abuse prevention and would also be required to work cooperatively with public safety departments and with the school district.
And I understand the location for this proposed dispensary has already been sort of looked at once before by an earlier proposal.
That's right. So the proposed location is in a vacant building at the end of a strip mall, 31 T-Ticket Highway across from Stop and Shop. And that building was targeted for the same purpose in 2016 by a nonprofit group called Seven Points of Massachusetts. That organization never really moved forward with the plan after Selectman declined to supply a letter of support for that group.
And Falmouth Police Chief Ed Dunn weighed in on this as the select board was discussing it?
He did. Dunn said he had talked to his counterparts in Mashpee, Cambridge, and Plymouth, where there are already medical marijuana dispensaries up and running, and that those chiefs have said they'd have no issues, law enforcement issues, as a result of the new facilities.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And with us on the phone right now is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, very interesting story this week about two people getting bitten by seals, and it kind of brings up a bigger conversation about the numbers of seals and the ways in which people are interacting with them.
Sure. Last week, two people, both young people, were bitten by seals at the Ryder's Cove Town Landing, which is off of Route 28 in Chathamport. A young boy was nipped in the palm, and a 17-year-old girl was bitten on the fingers of both hands. We talked to her, Beth Feinberg of Concord. She was rinsing her hands in the water off the landing's floating dock when she was bitten. Now, officials, boaters, and fishermen who work out of the landing say that seals, which have been present there for decades on and off, have just been becoming more aggressive there recently. And they apparently have learned to follow the boats as they come into the dock after a day of fishing, looking for a handout. And that's the result, they say, of people feeding seals and of fishing boats dumping bait and waste from clean fish into the waters, which keeps the seals around the area because those are snacks for them. And the seals have apparently learned to associate this food with the boats and most likely mistook Ms. Feinberg's hands for some kind of snack that was being dumped in the water. Now, her wounds weren't serious, but they did require treatment at Fontaine Medical Center, and she was given a regimen of antibiotics to take. Even a minor seal bite can really have serious consequences, officials say. They told us that bacteria in the seals' mouths can cause a disease known as seal finger, which, if left untreated, can cause really painful swelling of joints. But it's totally treatable with antibiotics. Now, the sign that was posted at Ryder's Cove and other town landings warned people not to feed the seals, to keep their hands and other body parts out of the water near the floats, especially when there are seals around. And this warning also goes for the fish pier, where seals have been a constant presence for many years and are also a nuisance, fishermen say. We actually had someone email us a photo this week of a seal sort of jumping out of, not jumping, but lifting himself out of the water and stealing a fish right off of a fishing boat at the pier.
Mm.
Yeah, so officials are really concerned about this, and like you said, Steve, it's a consequence of so many seals in the area, and just the interaction that is apparently inevitable with once the seals discover that they can, find a meal very easily by just sort of milling around these places where people are and fishing boats. But one of the issues is that feeding seals is actually a violation of the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act. We know that that act also prohibits people from getting within 150 feet of a marine mammal or a seal, on the beach. But it also says that if you feed a seal, that's considered harassment. These are wild animals. We spoke to people from NOAA and the International Fund for Animal Welfare. They said feeding these animals just conditions them to come back, and it's bad news, and it could really end up causing problems. But there's, other than warning people not to feed the seals and to keep their hands out of the water, there's really nothing can be done, since the Marine Mammal Protection Act also protects seals. They can't be removed like another wild animal might be, like a coyote or something. People just are going to have to learn, and education, they say, is really the core of what needs to be done in this case.
I thought it was interesting that the young woman who had her fingers bitten, who went to the hospital, she said that the people at the hospital had been trained to respond to things like shark bites, but they didn't know what to do for a seal bite, and they actually had to go consult the literature.
Right. She said they had to figure out what the consequences of a seal bite was, and fortunately there's a lot of literature about the seal finger on the web and in the literature, because apparently people who have for centuries who have harvested seals, especially up in Canada, and dealt with the seal pelts and everything, have contracted that disease. I don't know how regular it is. I don't think it happens much anymore. But we've always heard that seals had a lot of really bad stuff in their mouths, and you really have to stay away from them. And they can be pretty aggressive. They're big animals. They can weigh up to 800 pounds and be up to 10 feet long. Gray seals. If you see just their heads popping out of the water, they look cute and cuddly, but there's a lot of seal underneath the water there.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
With us in the studio, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, let's continue on the topic of marijuana regulation. Town of Barnstable has come very close to a vote on recreational marijuana, but a unique kind of objection stopped and postponed the vote. Tell us about this.
That's right. Some councilors said they thought this vote was going to be unanimous, but I guess seconds away from voting on a motion that would have allowed some recreational marijuana businesses to open, including cultivation, research and testing, but not retail shops, to operate in a designated zone in Hyannis, Councilor James Tinsley claimed a charter objection, which immediately stopped the vote. Now, when a charter objection provision is used by a councilor, it automatically postpones the vote on the issue until the next session. The provision can only be used once on a specific matter and only on the first time that the council is set to vote on the issue. So this won't be an objection that can be used again on the same issue. What Tinsley said, he's been a councilor for 10 years. He said this is the first time he's used it because he's a vocal supporter of retail sales and doesn't like that the state has given the towns the ability to ban them. He said that Massachusetts voted yes, and that's how it should be.
What was the response on the council when this objection came up?
I think some council members said that they thought they were pretty much done talking about the issue, that they thought it was a done deal. They called the use of the objection a powerful tool. I guess the planning board had met and recommended the amendment. They had deliberated on it previously and recommended it 4-1 to the council. So we'll have to see what happens.
We are going to speak now with not just yet. We're going to continue right here with Kristen. The town of Harwich already has one large-scale solar project, Kristen. Now it's taking a look at another.
That's right. So the first large-scale project, which is a 4-megawatt solar farm on the town's landfill, netted Harwich over $451,000 in fiscal 2017, and it also satisfied all of the town's electric energy demands. Committee member Larry Cole told Selectmen on Monday that the town could receive an additional $100,000 a year over a 20-year period by leasing a 9-acre parcel on town-owned land off of Queen Anne Road to a developer to install another 1.9 megawatts of solar power. And that's part of the town's bid to become designated a green community, which could allow the town to qualify for state grants and technical assistance.
What kind of rate are they looking at here, or what should we...
So Cole asked the town, he said the town should move forward quickly because right now the town could qualify for a rate of 17 cents per kilowatt hour, which is considered pretty high. However, there's a cap on how much power can be purchased at that price, and the fee that would be paid to the town drops after the cap for each price bracket is filled. So in 2017, the town received a lot of money from that first solar power project. However, the benefits this time around may not be as fiscally high for the town. This 8.9-acre lot is not cleared. That could lower the amount of money that comes back from the developer. Also, incentives offered by the state and federal government aren't what they used to be a few years ago. And in addition, the Cape's municipal market for solar power is pretty much saturated. There is a net metering program which allows towns who generate more electricity than they require to credit the excess to other accounts. And for example, Provincetown, which doesn't have enough land to put up a solar farm, receives credit from Harwich.
Let's speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, the Provincetown Tourism Bureau is spending plenty on social media. One of the things it's trying to do is attract a younger crowd in the summer, but it's not clear how feasible that goal is. Tell us what's happening here.
Okay, well, as anyone who tried to come to Provincetown last week during Carnival Week knows, tourism is the foundation of the economy out here in many ways. But a recent study that survey that was commissioned by the Provincetown Tourism Department found that 54% of the visitors to Provincetown are age 55 or older. Another 40% are 35 to 54. And only 6% are under age 35. And so the tourism people decided that that was a problem. They need to figure out how to attract younger tourists to come to town. And the way they are trying to do that is through what are called social media influencers. That is, they have hired people like the Instagram lifestyle photographer Jackie Greeny, who has 60,000 followers on Instagram, and Sarah Funk, who is called a lifestyle travel blogger with nearly 30,000 followers on Instagram. Sarah Funk's company is called Sarah Funky. And
so, Ed, are these people then, they're tweeting or Instagramming about Provincetown to try to encourage people to come there?
Exactly. Hmm. So in particular, one project that the tourism department has asked Sarah Funk to take on is creating short videos about Provincetown on YouTube. And so far, they've commissioned three of these videos. The first one, called What to Eat and Drink in Provincetown, was posted on July 9th. I just checked this morning. It's had 1,921 views. And the second one is called Five Ways to Get to Provincetown. A third one is supposed to be focused on this year's Portuguese Festival, but has not yet been posted. So, yes, they post videos, they tweet on Twitter, they put out pictures on Instagram, etc. And the idea, according to Tourism Department Director Tony Fasillo, is that will create a market for younger visitors.
Ed, tell us how much they're spending on the social media campaign.
This year they're spending over $50,000 on social media companies like Sarah Funk's. It goes through a woman named Nadine Lacoste, who has a company called Red Thread Productions. It's a public relations company. She has a budget of $38,000 a year with the town, but can also spend up to $70,000 a year on ad designs, market research, etc. And so there's a lot of money being spent here.
But there's some concerns about whether a younger audience is really even viable.
Well, that's exactly right. We talked to Kristen Reed, who is a recently elected select board member in Truro. She's 34 years old, young entrepreneur. And she said that she's all for bringing a younger generation to the Lower Cape, but she just doesn't think that vacations out here are really doable for that age group. She told us, "I don't think younger tourists can afford Provincetown." And in fact, an online search for hotel rooms during the summer found that the rates in P-Town varied from about $150 a night to over $400 a night. And even a day visit can be expensive. Food can be expensive, drinks, nightlife, renting bikes and kayaks and all. It adds up pretty fast. Kristen Reed says that she thinks a better solution would be to try and make it more affordable for younger people to move here and raise families and start businesses. And she named a few young entrepreneurs who have managed to do that, people like Rob Anderson and Loic Rossignon, who started the restaurant Canteen in Provincetown that has more reasonable priced food. And she says young entrepreneurs have the capacity to think about the wants and needs of a younger clientele because they are part of the demographic.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on that.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thank you.
With me is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, the saga of Falmouth's two wind turbines continues winding down. There are plans being made to take down the first one, but the fate of the second one is still uncertain.
That's right. So the two turbines, which were at the town's wastewater treatment plant, have been under a court order since June 2017, never to spin again. So plans are being made, as you said, to haul Wind 1 off the site, which has, you know, has neighbors breathing sort of a sigh of relief there. But Wind 2 is sort of still up in the air as to what's going to happen there. Neighbors have filed a complaint with the building commissioner on June 25th regarding a requirement that Wind 2 be dismantled and hauled away. One neighbor said he waited until the turbine had been shut down for 12 consecutive months and that should trigger a provision that it be dismantled and removed under the town's wind energy systems bylaw. Wind 1 had been shut down since 2015 when the Zoning Board of Appeals denied a request for a special permit for its operation, and a neighbor then had filed a complaint regarding Wind 1 in December, citing that the energy bylaw should require that it be removed, and the building commissioner, Rod Palmer, gave selectmen until the end of May to come up with a plan to remove that turbine. So neighbors are wondering why the same thing isn't happening for Wind 2. Town Council Frank Duffy said Wind 1 and Wind 2 don't share the same legal status, and that's why they won't share the same fate. He said that he ordered the dismantling and removal of Wind 1 because the structure didn't comply with zoning laws after it was denied a special permit. The Massachusetts Appeals Court had settled a lawsuit in 2015 determining that Wind 1 needed a special permit to operate. The zoning board denied that permit request, and that's when it was deemed inoperable. Wind 2, however, is eligible to be relocated in Falmouth with a special permit from the planning board.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young, and with us right now on the phone is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah is partnering with another tribe to build a gambling facility on the island. It's big news.
Yeah, so this has been in the works for a while, but at their annual meeting, the Aquinnah tribe voted to reach an agreement with Global Gaming Solutions, and they're part of the Chickasaw Nation based in Oklahoma. And they've worked with a lot of tribes to help them get gaming facilities up and running. Under federal law, the tribe is entitled to have a Class 2 casino on its reservation land. As your listeners, I'm sure, recall, there was a long, protracted legal battle mm-hmm. between the tribe, the state, the town, and some of the residents of the town. And it was actually up for consideration by the U.S. Supreme Court, but in January the court decided not to take the case. And so ultimately that led to the tribe officially having the right to build a gaming facility on its land in Aquinnah. They own or they have under federal trust nearly 500 acres. And so the details are still... Are still not public exactly what they're going to look to do on their land. There have been talk about using an unfinished community center to house, and this would be a bingo-style gaming facility, but it's not bingo in the traditional sense. You and I think about it where people sit and use their daubers. They look and feel like slot machines.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not actually slot machines. In order to have that, they would have to the tribe would have to have a compact with the state, and go through the Mass Gaming Commission process. But this avoids all that, and so it's going to be interesting to see exactly what it is that they plan to do. Town officials aren't weighing in yet, but when. Right in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision, they said, they're comfortable that this is all going to have to go through the process of the Martha's Vineyard Commission and other regulatory authorities on the island. So it's not going to open next week, but this is another step in the process, certainly.
I want to ask you about another story you covered this week. It was about a driver of a Vineyard Transit bus. This driver had struck two people in an accident this summer, and now it looks like he's not going to be cited in this.
That's right. This happened on July 26th, and it happened at night in Edgartown. Bus came around the corner on Church Street, and folks who are familiar with that will know that there's a pretty popular bus stop there at a visitor center. And as the bus turned the corner, there were two men in the road. They were struck and both injured, one more seriously than the other, but both needed to be hospitalized. And police are now saying that it was an unfortunate accident. Everything points to the driver, not being responsible in terms of being cited, but acting responsible that night. He was only driving less than 10 miles an hour and appeared to be alert. There were no drugs. There was no alcohol. He was tested for both. But an interesting aspect of this, Steve, is 5 days earlier, this particular driver had been stopped by police after they got a report of an erratic operator. And at the time, he told them he was just exhausted. He was working two jobs, one with the bus company and one with another company, and he was only getting like 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night. And he immediately quit that job after getting cited by police that day or stopped by police that day. And but out of an abundance of caution, the police chief in Edgartown, knowing that it kind of looked bad that they had stopped this guy a few days earlier, and then he ended up getting in this unfortunate accident, he called in the state police to do their own review. Mm-hmm. And both the Edgartown police in their investigation and the state police in their separate investigation came to the same conclusion that this driver wasn't at fault in this accident, that it was just, you know, bad timing. The two pedestrians were crossing, not in a crosswalk, just diagonally across Church Street, and he just couldn't stop a bus in time, even though it was only going less than 10 miles an hour before they were struck.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times is with me in the studio. Kristen, the outlook for AmeriCorps on the Cape, and that's the public service program, it was in jeopardy because of housing issues, but they now appear to be resolved.
That's right. The program was told last winter that it needed to vacate a county-owned property in Bourne. And at the time, local officials and AmeriCorps program alumni really stepped in to look for a solution, and it seems like they found one just in time for the next AmeriCorps Cape Cod group to report for its year of service on September 4th. So half of the 24 members will be housed in new quarters that were recently located. Six of those members will live in another county-owned house property in Bourne, while six more will likely be assigned to accommodations at the former Sheriff's Youth Farm in West Barnstable.
What else can you tell us
about
this?
So the remainder of the group is going to stay sort of where they've been for the 20-year existence of AmeriCorps Cape Cod, and that is at a home in Wellfleet owned by the Cape Cod National Seashore.
And the county is providing this, has made this available now for this AmeriCorps program to be able to use?
Yeah, so the county-owned house in Bourne became available when Gosnold on Cape Cod was ordered to vacate earlier this year. The property was one of seven cited by the state auditor's office as having no lease and not paying rent, which was causing a significant loss of income for the county. And officials are actually saying that these new accommodations are in much better conditions than the previous residents, which is obviously good for the incoming group of service workers.
The AmeriCorps group provides a tremendous service to these communities here.
They do. They work in throughout the Cape's 15 towns. They provide environmental, conservation, and disaster preparedness services. They staffed some of the shelters that were opened earlier this year during some of the storms and work on other projects. You know, I think they were involved in repairing some of the boardwalks and things like that as well.
We are going to speak right now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, Buttonwood Park is trying to deal with a problem that's making it unpleasant for human visitors. why don't you lay out the details for us here?
Okay, so last month, let's just back up a little. Last month, there was this widespread fish kill in the small pond that's located at Buttonwood Park. And some of the reasons put forth at that time on social media and tips into the newsroom and callers to the local radio station included accusations that city park workers put down herbicides to control the weeds, and that's what killed the fish. But so back then, we did a story about the pond, and we found out all of that wasn't true. We talked to state wildlife biologists, and they attributed the fish kill to an algae bloom, an unhealthy algae bloom. So algae, as you know, produces oxygen, and it uses it up at night. And sometimes when it's out of control, you know, bacteria can kill algae, and then you have a partial kill of algae, and it consumes all the oxygen at night and robs the pond of the dissolved oxygen that can kill the fish. So fast forward to mid-August, and we now have a pretty good idea of what caused the algae bloom. The most logical explanation is that goose droppings created an overload of nitrogen, phosphorus, and other plant nutrients, and that caused the pond's algae to grow wild. So park officials in New Bedford, now they have a new campaign to educate the pond visitors about this sort of the age-old truth about Canada geese. What goes in one end comes out the other. And so they want you to stop feeding the geese. It's a pretty simple solution, stop feeding the geese. And this is not new. You know, Canada geese, they can make a mess of a golf course or a public walking area. And when they congregate at a small pond, the cute little fuzzy gray goslings, they grow up to be adults. You know, excessive droppings can pollute the water. And so, you know, that has ammonia and all these ingredients. And, you know, we did stories dating back 15 years ago or so about, fish kills that happened. And, you know, one time in 2004, it was attributed again to goose droppings, but this time it was Aeromonas bacteria, which is in the droppings. And this week, Michael Bonner did a story noting that, yes, the problem is probably attributed to the geese, and there's other problems with feeding the geese. So if you feed the geese and families want to come to the park, and it's just a neat, fun thing to do with the kids, but it causes overcrowding. More geese come to the food source. It can actually delay migration of the birds. If they find food and have a local source of food, they'll stay longer. And the food that people bring to feed the geese, it's crazy. It's white bread. I've been at the feeding the geese at the Hoxie Pond in Sandwich. I've seen people there, feeding the geese, and they, I've even seen them feed them cheese curls, which whatever they have. So that has very little nutritional value. And so when young geese, goslings, eat that, they can grow up suffering from poor nutrition. It can hinder their development. They can get angel wing, and it makes them unable to fly. So it causes a lot more problems. It attracts more birds, which return the following spring. They lay eggs, and it creates a bigger problem for next year. So park officials say, it's now hard to go around the park in a lot of places without stepping in the poop, and that ruins the park experience for everyone. So Buttonwood Park.
So the approach right now is an education campaign, is that right?
Yes, there have been signs up, not to feed the geese, but they're trying to do more, and maybe there'll be more signs and get the message out that, just don't feed the geese. Mary Proza, who's the director of New Bedford's Park and Recreation Department, said, if people realize that feeding the geese is actually harmful to them, they should respond. Because really, people are feeding the geese because they like the geese. So, there's hope that educating the public will help. And Buttonwood Park is just such a beautiful little place. It's just under 100 acres. I think it's about 97 acres. There's a pond in it. And, it was designed by the architectural firm of Frederick Law Olmsted. So it's a wonderful place. And it would be a shame, that this temporarily blights the area. Don't feed the geese at Buttonwood Park.
Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com, New Bedford Standard Times. Andy, thank you for that.
Thank you.
With me is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, in Chatham, the select board has given the go-ahead on a dredging project in Pleasant Bay. There are neighbors here that do have some concerns about this.
That's right. So the project is adjacent to the south side of the 2007 inlet, and the idea is to make the channel safer for commercial fishermen and recreational boaters. As you said, Selectman did give the go-ahead. The town does still need to get approval from the Department of Environmental Protection, but a letter of permission was issued by the Army Corps of Engineers, allowing the dredging of 11,000 cubic yards of sand within a 90,000 square foot area. The cost for the project is expected to be about $145,000. And again, the purpose is to improve safety for boaters. The Coast Guard has come forward and said they support the dredging, citing the narrow channel as a potential hazard. The nonprofit Cape Cod Fishermen's Alliance also submitted a letter to the town saying they support the dredging and saying that their CEO said, really, he's amazed that someone hasn't had a collision there already. The channel is narrow. Oftentimes, commercial boats go out early in the morning when it's foggy and dark and visibility is an issue. It's also been used more frequently since the inlet known as the Chatham Break, which has served as the main access point to the municipal fishing pier and mooring fields for commercial and recreational vessels, has started to close up. So commercial vessels are relying on the 2007 cut more often. Some residents aren't quite so happy. Residents in the Minister's Point area across the bay from the 2007 cut have been concerned about new dredging. They say that a previous dredging done nearby in 2017 caused major property damage for them, and that the trenching there that was done at the earlier project has caused a riptide that has eaten away at the footing of waterfront homes there.
Kristen, I want to ask you about a story that you did. It's out in today's paper. It has to do with the Dennis Yarmouth School Board. There's been a long-running funding dispute between Dennis and Yarmouth when it comes to the regional school district. Now it looks like the school board is trying to find some common ground in this.
That's right. The school committee in the past has sort of taken a hands-off approach to any updates to the regional agreement, which has been a point of contention between Dennis and Yarmouth for years. The agreement is now 41 years old, and school committee members are saying that it doesn't reflect sort of modern-day academic things such as having charter schools and choice schools and having kids who live in Dennis and Yarmouth but may choose to attend those schools instead, and the fact that the district is financially responsible for those students even though they're actually not attending DY schools. As I mentioned, they'd taken a hands-off approach in the past, but 2 weeks ago, Yarmouth selectmen agreed to explore options for pulling grades 4 through 7 out of the district. And now, last week, 5 of the school committee's 7 members said maybe it's time to come in and try to mend some fences here and try to put forth some proposed changes that might not be exactly what either town wants, but could at least be a step in the right direction.
In the meantime, they're looking to move forward with a building project.
That's right. And I think part of the reason they wanted to step forward and sort of take on the possibility of updating the agreement is some of the animosity that's come between the two towns has resulted from the mechanism of paying for this $109 million new middle school that's being planned on Station Avenue. That school would replace the existing Mattakese Middle School and the Nathaniel H. Wixon Innovation School in Yarmouth and Dennis, and it's really been said that it's drastically needed, that conditions at those two schools are just costing the town a lot of money because things are out of date, and the buildings have been described by selectmen and committee members as crumbling and decaying and not safe or healthy for students. These changes, though, to the regional agreement wouldn't impact the funding mechanism for that school because there wouldn't be enough time in advance of a December 4th election, which would be a district-wide election that would give voters throughout the DY district the chance to vote on whether or not to approve funds for the school. There wouldn't be enough time before then for the school committee's subcommittee to make any changes to the agreement, to get them in front of the education secretary, and to get them approved at town meetings. Ultimately, any changes to the regional agreement will have to go through both towns' meetings.
So the idea with the school committee stepping forward is that they're not as partial to either town. They're only keeping an eye on the children's education. Is that right?
That's right. School committee chair Jenny Landers has said, you know, we're not going to do what Dennis wants. We're not going to do what Yarmouth wants. We're going to do what this school committee wants, which is ultimately in the best interest of whatever's in the best interest of the students. According to the current agreement, which would be used to fund the new school, that funding would be divided between the towns based on enrollment, which would have Yarmouth paying about $46.7 million, and Dennis paying about $23.2 million for the school. But the school is also on track to receive $61.2 million from the state, which is the real big issue there.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
And we heard from Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.